There are many answers to the question Rowan Moore poses in the title of his book, Why Do We Build? Some buildings are created out of a love of beauty, others from a quest for power or a desire to deceive, and still others from an urge to impose order. But as Mr. Moore points out in his sweeping examination of the thinking behind many of our most loved and hated buildings, whatever the initial purposes of any building as conceived by its architect and owner, begins to fade in importance as soon as the building is occupied and over the course of the building's lifetime can become an all but irrelevant point. Rowan Moore is not only an architect, he is also the architecture critic for the Observer of London and a former director of the London-based Architecture Foundation. His book is published by Harper Design, an imprint of HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, good evening.
I'd guess New York, it's afternoon. London, it's evening. I'd guess that most of my listeners would tend to think of buildings as being pretty fixed or static, at least once construction is finished. But you've come to see them as unstable. Isn't that a jarring word for an architectural critic to use? What do you mean by it?
Well, that's precisely what's kind of amazing about buildings and architecture, is that they have a number of paradoxical qualities, including this quality of being unstable, by which I mean they are never fixed. The story never finishes. So although building contracts are all about completion and design of buildings is all about measurement and fixity, buildings keep on changing. They change in an obvious way, which is that they get adapted, they get pieces added, taken away, they weather, they age.
Different people occupy them.
Often changes. People see them differently from year to year and generation to generation.
Does most of the architectural establishment share that view?
I think architects have a weakness for overestimating the extent of their control over the thing they're making. And they kind of have to do that, but I think they tend to be over-focused on the perfect object that's there on opening day, and they slightly underestimate what happens afterwards. And quite often they try and control what happens afterwards with unfortunate effects.
Aren't the architectural designs we see celebrated in glossy photographs and coffee table books and architectural magazines often treated almost as though they were art objects without context?
Yes. No, they're typically framed in ways that kind of downplay the surroundings. Of course, it's always a fixed moment, a photograph. It doesn't show how a building might change minute to minute or week to week.
And they're often shot in the morning when there's no need to worry about shadows or pedestrians.
The classical time to photograph architecture is early in the morning when it's easier to get the balance of light and shadow right, mm-hmm. But also when nobody's around. I mean, architectural photography has a great weakness for not showing people in the buildings.
You haven't included any of those gorgeous large-format color photos in your book. Your illustrations are in black and white.
There's a slight issue of budget in order to keep the book at its extremely reasonable price. We didn't go for big, glossy photographs. But we also wanted to show buildings more as they are really experienced, as things that are sort of around you, and which you don't always look at directly, but which are kind of seen out of the corner of your eye.
During the design process, architects tend to focus much of their attention on a building's form, but you've said the importance of form and shape is often exaggerated. Should architects pay less attention to form and more attention to other things, scale, context, light, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, form is a means to an end. A building is really an instrument for enabling other things to happen around it. I mean, what really counts are the spaces that a building makes, both inside itself and outside, in collaboration with whatever is around it. So it's extraordinarily unusual that an external space is the work of, in a city, is the work of one architect at one time. It's usually a composite of different works at different times. And that's just a fundamental part of urban experience, which architects kind of remember sometimes, but not always.
You're right.
So in other words, the fixed object is not the end in itself. It's the thing that changes your experience of the stuff around it and inside it.
And you write that architects need to think about how their designs relate to time.
Yeah. I mean, the heroine of the book is Lina Bobardi, who was an Italian-born Brazilian architect who flourished in there from sort of 1950 until 1990. And she, for me, really got it. Because the point is not that architects should be shy and retiring or kind of invisible, because when you do a building, it's a strong thing to do. So I'm not arguing for a kind of infinite reticence in sort of receding into the background. What I am saying is that architects should do their thing, but then leave space for other people to do their things. So what she did was, in a series of buildings in Sao Paulo and other cities in Brazil, was very strong buildings, which then left open spaces, which encouraged and invited people to change them and inhabit them and occupy them.
My guest is Rowan Moore. His book, Why We Build, Power and Desire in Architecture. It is published by Harper Design, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Because Ms. Bobardi chose to elevate this museum, she was able to create a plaza beneath it that's become a popular local attraction. And you said the public often treats architect design plazas like Christmas socks, well meant, but something that you can ignore. Why has Ms. Bobardi's design succeeded while others often fail?
I think it's partly luck. I think it's partly the nature of Brazilian cities that you make a space and they fill up. But she also just sort of seized an opportunity. It's on this big road in the middle of Sao Paulo, the Avenida Paulista. It's opposite a public park. There's a fantastic view. And then all she did was lifted her building up so that you can pass underneath it.
Well, we have buildings like that in New York, like the Lever House.
Yeah, sometimes they work. But she just captured the moment. And a big part of architecture is seizing what's there, not just going in and obliterating what is there already and doing your own thing. It's actually taking the chances when they offer themselves. And I would say the great New York example of that is the High Line.
Well, we'll get to the High Line in a little while. Miss Bobardi, who died in 1992, also choose to hang the art inside the museum in a very unorthodox way?
Yes, she did. So this museum, MASPE, in Sao Paulo, is a very simple concrete box clad in glass lifted above this plaza we've just been talking about. But then inside the box, she put this amazing collection of old masters inside a single hall, and she then mounted each painting on a vertical pane of glass that's secured at the base in a concrete block. So it's like a sort of just a sheet of glass sticking up out of the ground. That means you experience the paintings a little bit as the painter would have done when they were on an easel in the studio. And it means instead of looking at a painting fixed to the wall, where it becomes something like a window, something like a picture of another world. You look at it as a painting, as something painted, as an object in a space that you can walk around. And by filling the room in this way, she made a kind of forest of paintings and of the people wandering through them, such that if you're looking at the art, you're also looking at other people looking at the art. And in that way, she makes a connection between different actions at different times. So you have the historical actions of the painters who made these works that is kind of immortalized in the paintwork. And then you have the people in the present moment wandering around. And that's a rather beautiful way of making a connection between different kinds of time and different kinds of activity and action, rather than creating a series of sort of fixed treasures that you have to contemplate in a fixed way.
And you've said that the best design buildings propose and enable. They suggest what could be, they make things possible, and they give freedoms. And that's why you think this building is such a success. Well, the subtitle of your book is Power and Desire in Architecture, and I get the feeling that you had a lot of fun examining how and why many buildings have come to be built. Was one of your goals here to try to understand how human impulses are played out in building design and construction?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think we all know that building is not a purely functional activity, although it is profoundly functional in that buildings have a very important role in making civilization possible. It's very rare for a building to be built completely coldly and as a completely sort of technical activity. It takes a certain amount of energy and passion to get something built. And I think that's a pretty fundamental point that's not very original and that most people would know. What I was interested in was unraveling how that really plays out. I say that... I compare architecture to fashion, cuisine, and love. Fashion, cuisine, and love relate to clothing, eating, and reproduction, which are all also essential parts of existence, functionally essential parts of existence. But, of course, they go far beyond purely fulfilling functional needs. They're embellishments of those functions, which and those embellishments have become essential to us themselves, and architecture is like that. And it then becomes fascinating to look at the motivations of people who do build, because they're not always completely well balanced. They're not always completely reasonable, and what I find really intriguing is the way in which you have the desires, the thoughts, the actions of the people who build buildings. The buildings are then built, and then we who inhabit them have our own thoughts, actions, and desires, which we bring to bear on the spaces we inhabit.
And you're right that failures of architecture and building often occur because during design, emotional choices are disguised as practical ones. So is anybody aware of this collaborative aspect to the creation of architecture, the people who use the buildings? You're suggesting that the people who design them are not totally aware of it.
They tend not to be. It's pretty hard to know all the people and know all the feelings of the people who will inhabit architecture if you're an architect. In fact, it's impossible. But you still have to have an awareness that that's going to happen. I mean, that's where I say buildings are propositions. Stuart Brand said all buildings are predictions of the future, and predictions of the future are always wrong. I modify this to orbiting the propositions. In other words, it's a suggestion of what the world could be in the future that might be very decisive and positive, but it also has the humility to know that it's not going to be 100% correct.
Well, some buildings become classics, and others look dated almost immediately.
Yeah, which is something that can't be, which only really becomes clear over time.
My guest is Rowan Moore, the architecture critic for the Observer of London. His book, Why We Build, Power and Desire in Architecture, published by Harper Design, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Rowan Moore, an architect and the architecture critic for The Observer. His book, Why We Build, Power and Desire in Architecture, published by Harper Design, an imprint of HarperCollins in this country. Anyway, let's talk about that relationship between power and architecture. You look at it in many different ways. Most obviously, aren't buildings and monuments often designed and built to demonstrate the owner's power?
Absolutely. And all architecture involves a relationship of power. To build something, you have to have command over a piece of land and over some money and over a workforce. Something like the positioning of a kitchen in a home says something about the status of the person who cooks. So in 19th century houses, it might be something in the basement or a place where the servants would be expected to cook and out of sight of the rest of the house. In a modern home, it's more likely to be the center of the life of the house.
So it's just as true for a private citizen as it is for government and for a corporation?
Yeah, it plays out all the way through at every scale. I think it's almost impossible to imagine architecture that of any kind that doesn't have some kind of play of power in it. But as you were saying, it's a kind of very enduring theme of architecture that people with a lot of power want to commemorate it with buildings. Buildings tend to last a long time. They're a good way of achieving a sort of immortality. If you are able to command hundreds and thousands of people to move large pieces of stone around and organize them in perfectly symmetrical compositions, that's a pretty good way of demonstrating how powerful you are.
But it can also be used, you say, to give a false impression of power, which was the case with several structures that were built in Moscow at a time when Stalin was falling from power?
Yeah, I talk about this amazing All-Union Agricultural Exhibition, which is a series of buildings built on a large sort of campus in Moscow. And they show, they're a very good example of the role of architecture as propaganda. So they were a celebration of Soviet agriculture. It was started in the 1930s, in fact, at a time when there were enormous famines in Russia, in the Soviet Union, and continued through several more famines until completion in the 1950s. It was also supposed to show the love and fraternity of the unions of the different republics of the Soviet Union at a time when some were being violently repressed by others. And it wasn't supposed to show the power of Stalin. And in fact, it was completed pretty much at the point that he died. And after his death, of course, his myth, his personal myth, rapidly unraveled. Buildings can very often seem to be saying one thing, and the reality is another.
We saw the same thing in Romania with Ceausescu as he was about to fall
absolutely.
From power.
It keeps coming up. there's a brand new example opening next month in Baku, Azerbaijan, where Zaha Hadid has designed a quite phenomenal cultural center, which is also clearly a sort of trophy, a celebration of the power of the ruling family of Azerbaijan. I have no idea whether that's an indication that they are, their power base is unstable, but it certainly fulfills that.
But it illustrates another point, which you make, that architects tend to end up courting and working for powerful clients, probably because people in power have the money and the desire to build. But as a result, they sometimes end up in rather unsavory relationships. Hitler actually wanted to work for a Viennese architect, Otto Wagner, and he wound up with very strong opinions about what kind of architecture he wanted in the Third Reich.
He was actually turned down for a job with Otto Wagner. It's been, a lot of people have reflected on, maybe it would have been better if he had got that job and been able to pursue a career as an architect. But he was obsessive about building enormous buildings, about rebuilding Berlin as a kind of gigantic imperial capital. In his last days in the bunker, he was still looking at models of this city he was dreaming of. And it's kind of possible to wonder whether what was actually more important to him, whether it was to create the Reich, for which these buildings would be the sort of symbolic center, or whether the ultimate aim was really the buildings and the Reich was the necessary precondition of achieving these monuments.
Well, didn't Mies van der Rohe try to work with the Nazis in hope of keeping the Bauhaus alive?
Yeah.
He seemed to dislike the Nazis more for their poor taste and the fact that they prevented him from working than for their politics.
He made a very serious attempt to ingratiate himself with the new regime in the 1930s. And he did a design for the German National Pavilion at an expo in Brussels in the 1930s, which wasn't built, but he tried very hard to get this commission, and there are drawings by him of this project with swastikas on it.
Well, he described himself as apolitical, but his admirer, Philip Johnson, was a Nazi sympathizer throughout the 1930s. He even accepted a German invitation to travel to the Polish front with the Wehrmacht in 1939 so that he could write a series of anti-Semitic reports for one of Father Coughlin's journals.
He did indeed. He talked about the beauty of Warsaw burning, kind of what an inspiring sight that was. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
And then we have Le Corbusier courting both the Soviet Union and the Vichy regime when the collaborations regime in France. More recently, Rem Koolhaas is designing a building for the Chinese government, which raised some eyebrows. So is it just too tempting for an architect who has a big ego and wants to produce major works when dictators call?
Yes, it's very attractive. Architects have a little bit of a kind of dictatorial impulse themselves.
Are you speaking about yourself?
No, I'm not speaking about myself. Except in probably in very small ways, but I don't think I have a great urge to build large monuments across the world. But and also, sort of, it can actually get a bit more complicated, and the moral position, it becomes less clear. And something I find interesting is the transformative power of architecture. So, although an awful lot of buildings are built by very nasty people, some of those buildings end up being beautiful, loved, treasures an awful lot of the buildings that you might go and see if you went on a holiday in Europe or indeed Japan are not built by delightful people, but they are delightful buildings. So there is a kind of alchemy in architecture that can transform the motivations that originally lay behind it.
Now, you mentioned architecture as propaganda. You point to a series of buildings in Kijongdong, North Korea,
yeah,
as an example. What can you tell us about those structures?
Well, that's a town built in North Korea within sight of the South Korean, the border with South Korea, which was intended to show the modernity and prosperity of North Korea. But it's actually uninhabited. These are empty buildings with kind of lights going on and off inside to make it look as if somebody's home, but they're not. So that's a very bizarre example of architecture as propaganda. And I don't think that really conforms to this type I was just talking about of a building built for dubious purposes that end up being beautiful. I don't think that will.
Well, there have been
beautiful.
You also focus on building booms, especially in Dubai, but we could just easily talk about Hong Kong or Shanghai or a number of other cities over the world.
1920s Manhattan, indeed,
What's going on in Dubai? Some of it is pretty hard to believe.
Well, there's this kind of great property of buildings that they're both symbols and instruments, that they do something and they look as if they're doing something. So you can build a block of flats and it can actually have people living in it, or it can just look as if it has people living in it. And that property of architecture makes it very susceptible to abuse, if you like, during economic cycles. So what happened in Dubai in the boom was that huge quantities of money were put into apartment buildings and office buildings, of which there was very little prospect that they would actually be occupied in the foreseeable future. And but because of this property of architecture to look as if something's happening when it isn't, it sort of helped sustain the credibility of the boom. And architecture was very much implicated in the crash that happened there and elsewhere. But, I mean, exactly the same thing happened in the 1920s in Manhattan, when a lot of your most famous buildings were sustained by a bubble.
But they have done well over the course of time. Will the buildings in Dubai that have been constructed change as time moves forward?
It's over time, it's very likely that they will become inhabited and the perception of them will change.
Now,
this may well be very well known to your listeners, but the Empire State Building was known as the Empty State Building for about 20 years because it was empty. And that's now forgotten by most people.
Well, now it is. It also is a source of tourism, as is Chicago's architecture. And you note that Frank Gehry's 1997 design for the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao has had a tremendous impact on people's willingness to visit and invest in Bilbao.
Yeah. This is the kind of icon effect, of which Bilbao is the most famous example. That has definitely been overused as an idea in the time since then. I think the idea that purely doing a strange-looking building as a way of boosting a city has been rather overworked, but it worked in Bilbao.
Now, we have very little time, but I wanted to mention the High Line. That's a matter of repurposing?
Yeah. The High Line comes in my chapter about time, and it seems to me it fulfills or shows a good understanding of the relationship of architecture to time, in that it takes something that it was already there that already had certain properties that had been created over time. And it then created a setting for further future activities. So it's this understanding of architecture not as the creation of a completely fixed and final object that emerges out of nothing and then stays forever, but as an action that happens within history, an action that sort of inserts itself into a stream of time and deflects it, but doesn't damn it, if you like. And that, I think that's the kind of fundamental reason for the success of the High Line.
And other people are imitating it. I went to a sculpture park in Seattle, a very nice one, that had been inspired by the High Line. I'm assuming that people are doing similar things all over the world.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, every terrible development in London that's trying to make itself sound interesting says they're going to do something like the High Line. But it's possibly unrepeatable. The attitude behind the High Line, I hope, is repeatable and should be repeated as often as possible. But if you want to just simply replicate the High Line, you're misunderstanding it, because it is unique to a particular time and place.
We couldn't get to some of the things that I wanted to talk about. One of your chapters is Form Follows Finance rather than Form Follows Function. Mm-hmm. But I assume some of my listeners will be picking up this book, Rowan Moore's
the book, yeah.
Why We Build, Power and Desire in Architecture. It is published by Harper Design, an imprint of HarperCollins. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great. It's a pleasure. Thank you.